Welcome back to the Outdoor Adventures Podcast. Today in the studio, my good buddy, Kyler Galaski. How are we doing, Kyler?
Good. Thanks for having me over.
Yeah. We were hanging out here at the office and we were like, you know, what should we do today? Let's have a podcast.
Yeah. We don't really have work to do. I mean, a little bit, but...
I mean, you're busy.
Yeah.
The mortgage industry, the real estate industry ebbs and flows.
It does. I think, too, like... You work really hard for a couple hours, get all your stuff done, and then you kind of just field phone calls and deal with whatever. But as long as you get 2 solid hours in, you're good.
Yeah, that's all you need, really.
Honestly.
It's very feast or famine, too. Like, I'll be super slammed one day where it's like I can't hardly breathe. And then the next day, it's like, oh, I had 3 things.
Right. I think it's funny. People are like, you're always golfing. You're always doing this. And I'm like, well, yeah. Because I go into the office for 3 hours, get all my stuff done, talk to whoever I need to talk to, and then I'm done for the day, where some people go in and just like play Minecraft on their phone for 4 hours.
Right. Or surf Facebook.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to do that. I just want to work, get it done, and call it good.
Did you ever collect sports cards as a kid?
Yeah.
So you know what got me in trouble recently is those Facebook videos where the guys... film themselves opening up packs of cards, you know, and then they show the card that they got.
Yeah.
So they're chasing that rookie for the San Antonio Spurs. Mm. I'm a butcher his last name if I said it, but it's Victor Wembanyama, I think. So anyway, I bought a box of those of cards and I got a Victor, but then I was like, man, this is addictive. But then there's like a million of them on the market. Like, it's not really worth the price of the box of the cards.
Right.
But yeah, I did videotape that.
Cool.
So anyway, it was fun.
Lots of anticipation there.
Yeah. This is the topic of our show today is just random stuff.
Who was the Brian? Did he own the card shop downtown?
Yeah, Brian.
What was his last name?
Morton.
Brian Morton. I remember being a kid and he came to our elementary school and like did a thing and Pokemon cards were huge. And like, dude, we were all just like hooked on Pokemon cards. I had like John Elway rookie card in the case. Like
that was, you would have kept those Pokemon cards. They're worth so much money now.
Yeah. It's,
my brothers had like the big time ones and I don't know where they ended up, but they are crazy money.
Yeah. My parents gave me money to do that, but not like a lot. And some of those cards were expensive.
Oh yeah. And now they're like crazy money.
Yeah, like I was like $20. Holy smokes. And now it's like $2,000. Oh, cool.
Oh, some of them are like, it's like having a Mickey Mantle rookie. If it's graded like a 10 grade or gem mint or whatever.
Collecting stuff is a different,
it is weird. It's a whole different thing. And it's, none of us can take any of this stuff with us. It's an odd thing because it takes up space. It usually annoys your significant other in your life. You know, mm-hmm. if you collect anything. Mm-hmm. But for me, the gambling aspect, I think, is the appeal of like, I could open this thing and have this thing worth something.
You start collecting again, and then 10 years later, you're in the casino. You're right. Like, where's Sam? You just have a gambling addiction, crippling debt.
Yeah.
It's not funny to joke about, no, but
I'm not going to let it go that far. Oh, but okay. I bought the... It's called a Zulu NBA Ballers toy. It's in this little ball. And it's a similar thing. So you open this ball and you don't know who you're going to get. So I bought one when we were down visiting my wife's family for 4th of July. And I had my son open it up and he got the ultra rare LeBron James. Mm-hmm. And so we go on eBay and they're selling for like $120 and it's this $5 little plastic figure. I'm like, we're selling that. You know. So I sold mine for $70. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But then Michael's like, we got to go buy more.
Watch in a year, it's worth like $400.
Yeah, that's how it usually works out for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like real estate. Yeah.
Or stocks.
Should have kept that.
Yeah. We don't want to talk about GameStop probably.
No. Yeah. I was in on the GameStop before it was cool.
Yeah.
For like 6 months. And then elk season started. This is a good transition, I guess.
It is, actually. It's perfect.
So, yeah, my dad and I, we're going out for elk season. And I'm like, GameStop, telling them all about it. I'm like, dude, I got in on this. And I had a lot of shares and a lot of option contracts. And I'm like, I just don't want to like sit and watch it. I'm like, should I keep it or sell it? He's like, oh, just sell it. You won't have to worry about it. We got hunting. I made like a good amount of money, sold it.
That was the next day you sold it because I went hunting with you the next day and you sold it in the truck before we got in the woods.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Then the next week, it went from $30 a share to $400, I think, at the peak. And I calculated it out. I'm like, I would have had $1.3 million worth of GameStop stock.
So close.
Yep.
But you did make money. And the adage you always tell me is pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered.
Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered.
So get out with your gains and move on. And
I could have been a hog there, though.
Yeah. And then just torture yourself for the rest of your life.
No, I'm sure that'll happen again.
I started a new list on Robinhood that was stocks I should have held. And I just put them in there to just torture myself a little bit.
On your bedroom mirror.
Yeah.
As you go to work.
Yeah. Like, it's a good motivator.
If I would have kept this, that's equal to about 1,000 loans, but
yeah.
Yeah.
I'll just keep slinging loans because that's fun.
It's easy right now.
Yeah. But like Facebook's a good example. I bought on the IPO at like $40 a share and then it dropped to $8. So then when it got back up to 40 after 2 years, I'm like selling, breaking even, getting out of that baby. And now I think Meta's at like 550 or something. Yeah.
Sweet.
So, you know. But, you know, you live and learn.
Yep. So. You live and just stay broke, kind of.
Yeah.
With bad emotional decisions.
Yeah. So transitioning into elk hunting, you know, we'll get away from those GameStop options. But that did happen on an elk hunting trip. So, you know, elk season's just around the corner for archery season here in Oregon. And what are you doing right now to prepare for your hunting season?
Yeah. I'm doing something different this year. I started running in May. And I was not in great shape. I've never ran a whole lot, but I started running. I'm doing like 1 mile, 2 miles, blah, blah, whatever. It was pretty hard. And now this morning I ran 2 miles in 13 minutes and 56 seconds.
Dang.
Yeah. So like pumping them out. Yeah. I'll do some longer, slower runs too, but I went out hiking. We went to the Northwest Mountain Challenge together. And we had a big group and dude, I was just like cooking and I wasn't winded or anything. I'm like, man, there's something to that, I think.
Yeah, you were trucking pretty good. We had, that was fun. I'd never been to a 3D shoot before and, you know, it's up at Hoodoo and, you know, higher elevation. And in my mind, I thought we were going to be taking the lift a lot more frequently than we did, but yeah. We got some hiking in.
Yeah, realized, that's a long lift, like lift trip. For not going very far.
No, and I realized I really needed new boots. So I got a new pair of boots after that trip because mine tortured me.
I think anytime you go hiking and it's elevation and you're climbing and descending, you really learn to appreciate your boots.
Yes.
You're like, oh, you put a nice pair of boots on, like I have Crispies, and you just got a pair.
Yeah.
And like it just... You feel like you have a spring in your feet going uphill and it takes so much load off of your legs. It's crazy.
Yeah. So I had a pair of Keen boots that I had bought at Coastal Farm on clearance.
You say Keen or King?
It's K-E-E-N.
Keen.
Keen. But they looked comfortable and they felt comfortable in the store. But that day on the mountain, miserable. I mean, miserable. Like rubbing my legs raw.
Yeah.
They were like 400 pounds compared. So then we get back and we're hanging out in the parking lot. And Josh, he lets me try on his Crispies. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of debating Crispy or Kennetrek, you know, and going back and forth. And
they're both great boots.
But yeah, but once I tried his, I was like, I need a pair of these. Mm-hmm. And we happened to walk over to the booth and they had my size. And now I got a pair of Crispies. So
yeah, I got mine and I'm like, I asked the guy, I don't know much about gear. Like that's one thing I lack in probably is research, but I put them on. I'm like, how long do these take to break in? He's like, you don't have to break boots in if they fit you right. And I'm like, huh. I'm like, I've broken all my boots so far. So clearly they didn't fit me right. But I put those on and like, since I bought those, I'm like, dude, I will never not have a nice pair of boots.
Yeah. To me, that's probably the key element is having good boots, especially for up and down elevation and just,
or I mean, you're 15 on your feet mile all days. The time.
Yeah. It just doesn't make sense. We grew up always hunting in Danners and they're same. A good boot. There's nothing wrong with them. You know, they're comfortable. They hold up well. I mean, the Gore-Tex fades on every boot, I think. So, I mean, the pair I'd been hunting with had totally lost its waterproofing and I've tried to bring it back many, many times. So it was time.
You're just caulking it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just, you're dipping it. And
just paraffin wax dips.
Yeah.
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 But yeah, that was the next thing on my list was to talk about gear. So, but we didn't even really go into what you're doing to prepare for the season, did we? Other than running.
Yeah, I've been running. Josh and I hung a trail camp, just one cam. We kind of know where the elk were at, but we found a really good trail where they're crossing this drainage and it's like the only spot you can really cross. I think we had it up for 3 weeks maybe in June, and we had, I want to say, 6 different bulls. None of them huge, but like raghorns, and then there was a 5x6. We had like 8 or 9 bucks that went through there that were pretty good. And it was surprising because I've never really hung cams. And it was cool to see like, oh, like there's actually animals coming through here, even though it doesn't look like it.
And you've got the new cell cams?
No, I have. I don't even know. I bought a bunch off Amazon.
So you're like having to hike in to go retrieve your card?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just bought a new cell camera. I've got the old SD card ones, you know, and they work great, but you got to go in and get your card, right? And these new cell cams, you have to pay a subscription service, which I understand is typically around $10 a month, and you can turn it on and off.
Are they satellite? Like, do you have, or do you have to have service?
It's got a huge antenna.
So you don't have to have service?
I don't think so, because you can put them remote and then they will somehow send you the pictures that are happening on your camera. So I'm excited to try it. I bought it on Prime Day, you know, a little bit ago. So
Bezos.
Oh. Yeah, hooking him up. He needs the shout out. But so prep for me, I guess. You're definitely, I've never really elk hunted much, but just we have this Idaho hunt coming up in the fall, and in December, I was like, I got to do something to start getting ready. So you talked me into going to the gym, and I was kind of debating, should I do the CrossFit thing? Should I do the gym thing? What should I do? I just knew I needed to do something. Anyway, you got me into the gym, and I've been going 4 days a week, and I feel a whole lot better. Like, I felt like on that challenge, I was getting up and down, not as good as you guys, but I was hanging in there.
I feel like you're fine, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm stoked to see you going, and I think for anyone looking to get into any type of fitness regimen, I don't think it necessarily matters what it is as long as you do it consistently.
Yeah, and what for me, when I'm on that Stairmaster and it's got the little, you know, you're climbing a hill on it or whatever, I'm just telling myself, okay, that's one more ridge where that buck could be bedded or that elk's going to be or something. You know what I mean? I use that to motivate myself at the gym. Like, you can do it. One more ridge.
Right. Yeah, you have to have something that drives you, right? Like your purpose. And for a lot of people, it's like they want to go elk hunting or deer hunting or whatever. And for me, I worked at that gym for a number of years, and I would see this kid in a wheelchair. I think he was quadriplegic, and he would roll by every day. And people would come into the gym and they'd be like, oh, I don't want to work out today. I don't want to train, blah, blah, blah. We're humans. And I would always think of that kid. I'm like, man, that kid would probably do anything to be able to walk. Like, you know, and you have the opportunity to go work out and use your legs and lift weights and challenge yourself. And he has no opportunity to do that. So I always think of those people, or like veterans that sacrifice for freedom and like the work they put in. And it's like, I have the opportunity to work hard and be fit, and I'm going to like appreciate that.
Yeah.
And appreciate those people.
No, that's a good perspective. And that's a good motivator. It's kind of like doing it for somebody who can't do it, or making the best of who you want to be.
Right.
You know?
Well, I have the opportunity and some people don't. So yeah. I better appreciate it.
And just being healthier and being able to do the things we want to do without, you know, as much, it's going to be punishment no matter what. I've hunted with you before. I know you'd like to go into the deepest, darkest holes and, you know, climb your way out of them.
Yeah, but it's so, when it works out, you feel so accomplished. You're like, dude, I think killing a bull in the national forest on the coast is like, I don't know if there's anything that's going to top that for me, because you put in 160 miles, 200 miles of hiking and like disappointments and failures. And then it finally all comes together and you're like, dude, I just did one of the hardest things you can do with a bow.
Yeah. And how long have you been elk hunting?
Since I was 23.
So how many years is that?
Nine years, I think.
So 9 years, and you've taken 3 bulls?
Yep. One with a rifle in Idaho, but yeah.
So 2 Rosies in the coast with your bow, and then an elk in Idaho with a rifle.
Yep. And there's a couple years I didn't hunt a whole lot. And the first couple years I was like self-taught bow hunter. So first year didn't see any elk. I'm like, what are these things even? do they live here? I don't know. And then it slowly progressed. I kept learning. I missed opportunities on cows when you could shoot a cow. I missed a cow over in Eastern Oregon, out of Christmas Valley. And then I started to get into bulls and blew opportunities with them, bugling at the wrong time or not getting set up correctly. And like all those failures, I kept learning and learning. And now I'm to the point where I'm like, oh, I have a pretty good idea of what I'm going to do in each scenario.
Yeah. That's, I mean, 3 bulls in 9 years is pretty darn good in my mind. So I've never killed a bull. I have taken cow before with a rifle, you mm-hmm. know, with a rifle tag. But the archery thing was totally new to me. I don't know when we met each other, but we were just talking about the story the other day, but we had just met each other.
April 2nd, 2018. I'm just kidding.
That would be hilarious. I'd be like, I don't know. But anyway, I don't remember if we were, I think you were in my office maybe, and I have my mule deer hanging on the wall or something. And you're like, oh, you hunt? Oh, you fish? You know, because mm-hmm. some people don't do that around here, even though we have a lot of opportunity. You're like, I'm going to go scouting or archery hunting this weekend if you want to come. I'm like, well, I don't even have a bow, but I'll go for a hike with you. And so I go with you and your buddy Lyndon. And I mean, Lyndon is, talk about being in good shape. These guys are like walking circles around me, and my face was all puffed up and I'm hot. And
yeah, Lyndon dying. Could run me into the ground.
Oh, he would literally run back from the top of a hill to check on me. Are you doing okay?
Yeah.
And then I'd look up and he'd be back on the top of the hill.
He is one of the most fit people and like determined. And
yeah. But it was kind of the first time I'd ever kind of tried the archery thing. And then and next thing you know, I'm down at the bow rack buying a bow and getting fit for that. And I still use kind of the archery hunting as a backup plan to my rifle season when it comes to deer hunting. Mm-hmm. But as far as elk goes, I think I went with you 1 year, then maybe I took a year off, and then I went last year with my cousin over on the east side and just kind of checked out how he does it. And, you know, we were in elk. I was only able to go for like 3 days, but we were in elk 2 out of those 3 days, and we had a 6-point bull that we were calling in, and just seeing that experience, and it was really cool.
Yeah, like harvesting an animal is like almost, that's the goal, but it's like a bonus because you're like, dude, just seeing them, interacting, calling them in, like that's so fun.
Oh yeah,
I don't know anyone that wouldn't have a good time doing that.
So back to gear, what do you have in your pack, on your daily pack? So depending on, let's just talk about a day hunt for now, not like an overnight time.
Yeah. If I'm going to the coast for the day, I'll probably get there. I don't like to get there early. I'm kind of lazy. The elk are lazy. I try and match that energy.
Yeah.
No, we'll get there just a little bit before light. We'll have a plan together, but I'll have a water bladder I usually bring 3 liters of water, which might be overkill. I sweat a lot. A couple snacks. I'll have my bino harness on with my binos, trekking poles, ultralight game bags, a bone saw, knives, my release, my bow. I'm trying to think. Oh, I bring a little bit of moleskin in case I get a blister on my foot. I bring a little bit of duct tape. Trying to think. My calls for sure.
Are you bringing rain gear? Because we're in Oregon. It's a little wet out there.
Usually in September, it doesn't rain a lot. And if it does, it's not really cold. And we're hiking so much that I have merino wool on for a shirt and it dries out so fast. So I don't typically, unless I know it's like torrential downpour, and I try not to hunt when it's pouring down rain.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
I remember the year I went with you, we went in the rain quite a bit. I remember having to back into the bushes so that I wouldn't get soaked.
Yeah. The National Forest, is that like the most... Is that a different experience than you've ever had, probably?
As far as how dense it was, mm-hmm. until you get in there, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, we're going in here. It's straight down and so dense that you can't see in front of you. Yeah, I hadn't really experienced that. Because the east side, it's a lot more open. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still brushy spots. But
you don't have to beat through it to get to where you want to.
Typically, you're seeing an animal and maybe you have to get through some areas that are a little crazy to get to that animal, but at least you kind of know where you're going.
Right.
You know? Versus this is like, hey, we just got out of the rig and now we're going straight downhill into this bush.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. But yeah, the gear, a good pair of boots, and then I think that's pretty much it, man. A rangefinder, obviously.
Oh yeah.
But you don't need a whole lot. Just some snacks, water, your gear.
And I like that. I like the idea of being a little lighter with your pack, because you're going to haul it around all day. And then if you do harvest an animal, then you got a little bit of room to maybe get that first load out, you know?
Right. And it's way different than doing a backcountry hunt, because mm-hmm. you can get to the pickup. And like, we do bring a Grail water filter, because there's water in almost every drainage on the coast. Mm-hmm. So that way, if you want to put just a liter in, you know, you're going to the bottom, you can just pump a few water bottles full of water, throw it in your bladder, and you're good.
So when I worked for the Forest Service, when you were probably not born yet.
What year?
I'm not sure. It was
72.
It was 2000, probably 2003.
I was 11 years old.
Yeah. So you were 11. I was going 7-9 miles a day in the woods. We had these Forest Service issued water bottles that would go on your hips, and they were these giant plastic canteens.
They had sweet gear for you guys, probably.
But they said U.S. Forest Service on the side of them. I had to turn them in when I left that job. But we would go pump our water and fill up those. And then Camelbacks just came out. So when I got that Camelback, everybody was like, look at this guy's gear. Like, holy cow. You know?
Yeah.
It was a big deal.
They're jealous. They're like, yeah. Damn, bro.
Where did you get, how did you afford that?
You don't have canteens?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a different gear. Has come a long ways. Uh-huh. And I mean, good gear does make a difference.
Oh, 100%.
I'm slowly adding gear for this Idaho hunt so that I don't get in too much trouble, you know, by buying it all at once.
Right. Cause it's expensive. But yeah. Once you have good gear, it typically lasts a long time. And we've all been in that spot. I remember when I first started hunting, I had Walmart camo pants, shitty boots, and like a rain jacket that didn't really work. And like, your gear sucked. And that's how you started.
Yeah.
Like as a kid, and we didn't have a lot of money. Yeah.
I mean, it still gets the job done. It doesn't have to be, but it is, there's certain things that do make it a lot more comfortable.
100%.
So, I mean, you're focused mostly on the west side, coastal elk hunting generally has been your, of the 9 years you've hunted, that's been, I mean, you did do some in Christmas Valley. But
yeah, I've hunted in Christmas Valley a couple times, and that's like desert and sage. And there's some junipers that they go up into, like they travel pretty far over there where we hunt every day to and from the alfalfa fields. But yeah, the coast, I've hunted the Cascades a little bit, but not a ton. I mean, last year we hunted the Cascades out of Springfield. And we saw quite a few elk and had some pretty close calls, but never quite sealed the deal. But yeah, mostly the coast, I would say.
Yeah. And for me, the elk hunting was like, I went maybe 3 times as a kid on that same cow hunt. And we were hunting the Ochocos, and there used to be a cow tag, but they privatized that now. So you can only hunt on private property with that tag.
Like LOP damage tags or something.
I mean, there's a tag you can put in for, but they tell you right on it, like if you get this tag, you need to know someone with private property because it's only private land.
Gotcha.
So it used to be a public tag.
So it is a damage tag basically.
Yeah. Okay. And so back when we were growing up though, there was, you would go find the herd, and with the cow tag, you just made sure you didn't shoot a bull. And it was a pretty fun hunt, and you were typically hunting in the snow in November, so you could get on tracks and follow those. So I actually only had the tag in my pocket twice, and the first time I went, I was pretty young, and I didn't really even hunt it. But then the second time, we were on elk every day, and I got my cow. And but my uncles and cousins hunted it a few more times, and they've had some bull tags over there. But really, I didn't really hunt elk. I was just mostly a deer hunter, and then we would buy elk tags, but never really hunt them for rifle. But getting into it with a bow is just such a different experience. And the ability to call an animal and have it respond. I mean, the first time that actually works and you see it happen and all of a sudden you have a bull at 150 yards. That's what happened for me last year for the first time. And I was just like, man, this is incredible.
Yeah, it's so cool. And I think you could attest to this, but you have the whole month of September with an archery tag, and that's why I like it. I don't enjoy killing things with a rifle as much, I don't think, but that's besides the point. I like being out in the woods with my friends, with my family, hunting, and the rifle elk tags over here, the Cascade tag, I think it's, what, 5 or 6 days maybe?
Yeah. It's like maybe a week at tops, yeah.
And the coast has two seasons. It's a 4-day hunt, and then they have a 7 or 8 day hunt.
Yeah, and they used, I read a newspaper article years ago, so I don't know if this still holds, but they used to call the general season tags the 2 percenters because the success rate was like 2% for harvest on those.
And there's probably about 18,000 more people in the woods compared to archery.
So many people. Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's going to be people no matter what, generally, it seems like. I mean, maybe not as much on the coast, but...
The coast is brutal, dude. I did it with my dad, that coast tag. And there's like a truck at every gate. Where during archery, it's like you might see 2 other rigs, 3 other rigs for like 3 days.
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
That's huge. So do you have any tips for a beginning caller? So I'm trying to get into calling. My cousin, my other cousin Dylan, who lives on the east side, he's a really good elk caller. And so I bought, you know, the reed calls and just, they're just weird. You know, I try. I mean, like we talked before we got on the air here, like, you know, I'm probably trying once every couple months. I'm not trying for a long period of time.
Yeah. So I think the, what was your question? Like
tips for a beginning caller.
Okay. I think that you could look at this a couple different ways. I think where we're hunting right now, the elk are pressured in the Cascades. And from what I experienced, they were not as vocal as the coast. And so we have a plan this year that's like, hey, we're going to sit in glass. We kind of know where the herds hang out. And we're going to try and locate them and go in silent and make no noise if we can put them to bed. Mm-hmm. You know, because why would you give up your location if you know where the elk are?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, and then I think, aside from that, if we don't know exactly where they are, going into areas where they could be and doing a little cow party. So just like sound like you're 10 or 15 cows talking and then shut up and wait 30 minutes, 40 minutes and wait for a bull to kind of be curious and come in. I think people, I was talking to the guy at the river yesterday and he's like, the mistake people make with that is they keep cow calling and that bull will sneak in and you won't be able to see him, but he'll hear you calling and he'll be peeking around and looking for the cows and they're not there. Mm. And that's a pretty big red flag, I think, for them.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think being quiet, shutting up and just being like letting that curiosity kind of bring them in.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, last year for me, when we went in pretty early, so it was dark outside and we weren't using flashlights or anything. We had a little bit of red light, you know, and
just spotlights mainly.
Lots of that. But cool. No, we were just going in really slow. But my cousin was ripping like a locator bugle every once in a while. Uh-huh. And we laid down in the spot we wanted to wait at until first light. And he does another locator bugle and I go, I heard a response. And he's like, no, you didn't, you know, like you're full of it, you know? And I'm like, so then he tries another one and sure enough, and this elk was a long ways off and it was coming, you know, he got it to start coming in. And well, then we got in a position where it's like not light enough to shoot and this thing's on us, mm-hmm. you know, it sounded like, I don't know how close it actually was. And then by the time the light's out, we could see the elk at like 150 yards. And we worked on him for like 3 hours and he would not come closer than that.
Did he have cows?
He had cows away from him, not with him.
Yeah, he didn't want to leave them.
Yeah, and he was a big 6-point bull. And
was it later in the season or early?
It was just like, my cousin said we timed it perfect because they hadn't been very vocal and then there were some fires and so it was kind of smoky and hot, you know, and they were only vocal in the mornings. So it was kind of like towards the end of the season, but there's still maybe 2-3 weeks left. And so anyway, this guy was super vocal. We got him within that 150 yards. And then another hunter from a ridge over ripped like a challenge bugle. And he was like, nope, these are humans. And he bounced.
Right.
You know? And so that was the other thing I heard on another podcast is like the elk are starting to get used to people being a elk sounding noise in the woods. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to me that they would start to clue in on that.
Yeah. And they obviously are communicating different things with different sounds, right? Mm-hmm. So like, a roundup bugle is way different than a challenge bugle, which is way different than a locate bedded mm-hmm. bull bugle. You know, there's like different calls. And if you're just ripping off big growly bugles everywhere, like that's not, unless you get a bull that's super hot and fired up.
Right.
Like most likely not going to work for you.
Yeah. And we, the next day, we couldn't get anything to respond to anything. So my cousin's just goofing around and showing us the Hoochie Mama call, and we're sitting there taking a break. So he's just doing that. And we go around the corner, and there's two spike bulls that had come into that, and they're standing there, you know, like 80 yards.
Yeah, because they're a herd animal, right? Elk are. So like those raghorns and the spikes that maybe get kicked out of the smaller herds or whatever, they're staying close. They're satelliting the herd, satellite bulls, right? And they want to be close to cows. And also like during, as we move into rut, right, they're looking for some action. They're looking for a couple cows,
a cheap
here.
Shot.
Yeah, exactly. They can sneak,
like a sneaker salmon.
Yeah,
you know, beat the big bull.
Yep, exactly.
Well, I'm going to shift gears a little bit here and talk about how your tactics, unless you have more to say about the coast, but what I was going to say is, how did your tactics shift when you went out of state? Now, granted, I know we're archery hunting versus rifle hunting, so it's a totally different game. But did you feel like some of the tactics that you use here in Oregon played in Idaho?
We're hunting wilderness in Idaho, and there's some open faces, there's thick timber, there's like a big diverse range of landscape, I guess. And so really it was a lot of glassing and paying attention to like, there's more sun on the south slopes. They're probably going to come out and feed when it's warmer in the afternoons and evenings and go back into that timber. So you're like checking those areas, glassing, looking for that herd, spending a lot of time doing that. Whereas on the coast, I'm probably walking old cat roads and looking for sign, looking for rubs, and doing little locate bugles or cow calls every once in a while and waiting and then moving on. It's quite a bit different, I think.
So none of those tactics from here really played there. I mean, general hunting tactics, obviously, and animal behavior, but.
I mean, other than knowing like, hey, they're feeding where there's feed and they're going to be out when it's warmer because it was November when we went.
Well, that's the thing I remember about hunting the coast with you. It was like, okay, the herd's going to be here or here and we're going to go 15 miles to try to find them. But if they're not there, then they're going to be over here, which is another 15 miles away. You know?
Right. Yeah. The coast is challenging because you know they're going to be in a drainage, but you don't necessarily know what part of the drainage they're going to be in. So honestly, getting into a drainage, walking like I would say halfway down the drainage and then side hilling and looking for sign, looking for trails, and you just keep going. And once you find fresh sign, you know they're probably close. And that's when you can slow down and try and get into their bubble. And if you see them or know they're close, you don't necessarily have to call, right? You just keep following that sign until you're in the herd.
Yeah, if they're not spooked or something, you know, why, like exactly. You said earlier, why bring the attention upon yourself?
All the times I've called elk on the coast, bulls, anytime I'm not within 150 yards and I bugle, I have pushed them away, and that was probably bad calling or just not making the right decision. But anytime I'm within 150, I get them to fire back.
Okay.
Yeah. So once I'm in their bubble.
The sweet spot. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a core, when you brought up the fresh sign, that's like a core hunting memory for me on that elk hunt where I harvested that elk. You know, we're on tracks in the snow. And then all of a sudden I start smelling elk and then I'm seeing steaming pee and steaming poop. And you know, like we're on them and they're clearly not running. So that was so cool to me to all of a sudden to be able to track down a herd like that and just be that close where you're smelling them.
Yeah. And they stink and you know, you're close if you smell them, right?
Oh like, yeah. It's the coolest smell though. Like you're like, oh my gosh, that's elk.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like it hits you all of a sudden.
And you never forget it.
Oh no. Like that's locked into my brain forever. One of the other things I had down here along those same lines is decoys. What about having a cow silhouette decoy or something? In that example you brought up earlier where that bull is hearing those cow calls, he comes in to look for the cow. Do you think a decoy, like one of those Montana decoys, would help?
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of guys that use them. And they do. I've just never done it because I've either hunted with people that were newer and or weren't great callers. So I'm always calling and shooter and their shooter. So we haven't been able to do the best setups, I would say.
Because it's a lot to carry if you're bringing the decoy too.
Yeah, and you're calling and you're like ranging. You're like, oh, that tree's 50 if they come there. That one's 60. Like there's just so many things, and you add a decoy and that's just another thing you have to worry about. But yeah. I do think it could be super helpful in those situations where you can throw up a little cow if maybe they see you or they're hung up. You can throw up the cow head and they see that. That might settle them down a little bit.
Yeah, it seems like it would.
Yeah.
You know, and they probably will, it'll cause them to just, they probably will recognize that it's not what they thought it was, but it maybe gives you that little extra moment, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
Last question was mistakes that you've learned from in your hunting past as far as elks, like elk hunting. So like what, I guess, major lesson do you feel like you've learned?
Can I do more than one?
Oh, yeah, totally.
So we were hunting down south with my cousin Kyle, and he's like, hey, there's bulls in here. We saw them first thing in the morning on the road going out, couldn't find them, blah, blah, blah. So we go out and we start putting calling setups together, and we went down onto this landing and kind of tucked away in the brush, and we cow called and threw a couple like chuckles or bugles or whatever, and we sat there for 15 minutes and we're like, okay, like, cool. Let's walk back up to the pickup and find a different spot. Walk up 15 minutes to the truck, start driving the ridge above where we were. And I look down and there's a 6x6 and 8 cows standing on the landing we were calling at. Mm. And I'm like, man, people always say, be patient and wait at least 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And when it finally happened to me, I'm like, okay, from now on, if I do this, I'm setting a timer for 30 minutes.
No matter what.
No matter what.
Yeah.
Another experience, I walked into this meadow where I knew the elk kind of hung out. And I think they heard me coming in, and the cows busted and the bull was out in front. And I start calf calling behind them, and they're hanging up and calling back to me, hanging up. And I'm like gaining ground on them. And I was newer at this time. And my buddy Joe is with me, and I'm like, I'm going to try and like bugle this bull. And I rip a bugle. He bugles back to round up his herd, and which I didn't know. And then I don't hear anything for like a few minutes. And so we keep following him. I rip another bugle. He bugles back, and he's probably about 500 yards further away from us. And so like, if I just kept calf calling and like trying to get into their bubble,
because it was working,
right, they would have probably hung up and waited for me to catch up to the herd. Mm. But me being an idiot or inexperienced, like I just blew that bull out of there by thrown out a bugle for no reason.
Yeah.
It was like the dumbest thing.
If something's working, don't go away from it or try to fast track it.
Well, if you think about that situation in your head, right, you're like, they heard something coming and they busted. The wind was good, so they didn't smell me. I'm calf calling. They're calling back. They think I'm an elk, like part of the herd. And so why would I not use that to my advantage? Because they didn't think I was a bull. Otherwise, they would have stayed there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so me, just a bull comes out of nowhere and right. just rips a bugle while they were busted out of this meadow. It's like, that doesn't make any sense.
That calf matured really quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was a mistake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's hunting. You know, mm-hmm. the different tactics work at different times. And when it goes the way you plan it, you feel like, man, I got this figured out. But then you could use that same tactic another time and it might not work.
Right. I think raking is super underutilized, and Josh and I spent a fair amount of time raking on the coast, and we got bulls to start raking back, and like you could hear them tearing up trees and stuff early. They weren't vocal, but you could like, it's a more subtle method, and like that bull thinks you're a bull tearing up a tree, and it gets him a little bit fired up and he starts raking. And I think if you can work them up and work up that energy in them, then you could maybe get them to come in.
Yeah, they might not be thinking as clear, or they got those hormones are starting to rage. And
right, if he's just hanging out, feeding, bedded by himself or whatever, and you go in there and rip a huge bugle, he's probably like, dude, what? Like, I don't want any part of that.
This
like,
guy
I'm
is doing way my, too fired.
Yeah,
up.
I'm doing my thing. Like, I'm just gonna get on out of here.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's there's a lot to it. There's so many little elements, and it's the other thing that I think to your point of just being patient. If you think about guys that are always like, man, I get all these pictures on my trail cameras, but when I'm out hunting, I don't ever see anything. Well, sometimes, you know, their trail cameras, they're getting a picture of a bull every 7 days, but maybe they're in a hot area and they're getting elk every day or every other day coming through there. You got to think if you just were patient and could sit still in a good spot where they're not going to see you mm-hmm. or smell you, if everything plays right, at some point the elk are going to come through.
Yeah.
You would
I've,
think.
I've never done it, but I think a tree stand, if you found a really heavy used trail and you're like, hey, I'm going to spend Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like sit in the stand because they're coming through here every few days.
Yeah. Like, I know they're going to come through most likely.
You'd be pretty successful if you had the ability to be patient and the discipline to sit in that stand for 12 hours straight, 3 days in a row.
Yeah. One of the most successful hunters I know, I'd like to have him come on the show, but him and his wife both deer hunt and elk hunt mm-hmm. and they antelope hunt. I mean, they hunt everything, but he, I don't know where he goes, but he goes over east and he's been archery hunting forever, but he sits in a tree stand the entire time and he kills giant blacktails. He will shoot a cow or a bull, whatever walks in front of him first. But he's very, very successful and it's all self-climbing tree stand hunting,
which is cool. But I don't know if I have the patience or the tenacity to do that. Like that doesn't interest me as much. I like to timber sneak for blacktails and be moving, and that's fun, right? Mm-hmm. Even though you're going really slow, it's more of like a pursuit, I guess.
Yeah, I think having that, you have to be really patient, but also it's time goes really slow when you're sitting like that. I think.
Yeah, you know, even when you're glassing, you're like, how long have we been here? And you're like, 12 minutes.
Well, glassing can get my attention because I'll see something or I'll see some does or whatever. Something will catch my eye and that'll keep me getting excited about it. Whereas if I'm just sitting in a spot waiting for an animal to come across, like even those blacktail archery hunts we went on a few years back with Dylan, and we're sitting there and sitting there and sitting there, I'm just like, oh.
Right.
And then you look down and you're like, it's been 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I thought I'd been here for 4 hours, right. You know?
And that's a sliver of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to know what they're doing. Like they're probably feeding and then right as it gets light, they're already headed back to the timber. They're going through the timber to a place where they feel safe and they bed down. And so like that morning you either want to be, if you're archery hunting, probably in a transition area and wait for them to come through, or like as that morning progresses, as they get further in the timber, you're probably going to want to be sneaking really slow, trying to find them hanging out or getting ready to bed on the edges of like brush and a clear cut or whatever.
So is this getting you excited?
I'm pretty excited. Yeah.
You are already excited probably.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pumped.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the amount of activity you guys have already got on the trail cameras, it's feels like it's going to be good.
I think it's going to be good, and I think we know where the herds are. And so as long as we hang out around the herds, we should be able to call bulls in.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate you taking the time. This was fun. We should do it more often. I don't know why we don't, but it's always it's good to talk hunting with you and just learn from you. You've done a lot more elk hunting than I have, for sure.
Yeah, I would say you have about 20 years, 30 years of experience on me, though, for hunting in general.
Yeah, general. I can give you some general and definitely some mule deer stuff, but
I've never shot a mule deer.
Yeah, it's
I shot a mule deer doe. I take that back in Idaho. Oh,
yeah, there you go.
I don't know if that counts.
I think it counts.
Yeah.
Harvesting animals, harvesting an animal.
I just wanted meat.
Yeah, that's how I am. We get too antler lusty sometimes. I don't know why that is. I mean, antlers are cool. Don't get me wrong, but
I think once you've killed a couple, you're like, it's like the challenge of killing a bull that's smarter, mm-hmm. like that you have to work harder for.
Yeah. I just want to get that first one.
Oh, so. Yeah. Like I'll shoot a spike this year. I wouldn't care.
Yeah. I'll definitely shoot a spike.
Yeah.
Any bull that walks in front of me, I will release an arrow if it's within range.
I like that. Within... Yeah. 80 yards.
Probably. I got to shoot some more. I just turned my bow up a little bit, so I need to get more comfortable because I'm not shooting super tight groups at that distance. Hmm. So, I mean, you saw me at the Northwest Challenge.
Yeah.
I was happy to hit foam on almost every target. The only one I missed was that like 110 bear.
And I feel like you weren't you were concentrating, but you weren't like really concentrating.
Yeah. And I didn't really even understand how the point system worked, so that you're trying to hit, you know, kill shots. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, hey, I hit the target. I'm pumped. I mean, I was trying not to shoot him in the leg, obviously, but I was just trying to kind of hit center target.
Leg shots are tough.
Yeah. It's hard on the arrows too.
Really hard when you hit that steel pole.
And those Axis spines are sweet to pull out of foam targets, I found out.
Yeah. The carbon on them, or whatever the material is on the outside, it really just sticks in there.
Yeah.
It's tough. Well, thanks, dude.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. All right, buddy.
All right.
Later.